Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
One of the most amazing parts of what I do is the privilege of hearing stories of fascinating people. And today's show is one of those special occasions. My guest name is Dr. Leona Stuckey. She has a degree in psychology and philosophy from Boston College. She attended Andover Newton Theological School and Eden Theological Seminary. She has a doctorate from Southern Methodist University with honors. She is an author and a speaker, a mental health professional. She began her life in a Mennonite community and culture. And yet, far from what you might expect, Leona Stuckey not only rejects any belief in God, but she titled her book, her memoir, The Fog of Faith, Surviving My Impotent God. This is a very personal story of dreams and expectations and shame and violence and escape and freedom. And she is here to share some of that story with us. I am honored to have Dr. Leona Stuckey on the show. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you. I am so pleased to be with you, Seth.
To those who are just now being introduced to you, take me back to square one. Kind of tell me the Cliff's Notes version of your story, if you would.
I grew up as a Mennonite on a farm in Kansas. And you know, those rural Mennonites are a little more Mennonite-ish than urban Mennonites. But we were the more liberal branch of the Mennonite churches. And so we had your basic necessities, electricity and cars and those kinds of things. But we were very strong believers. And so one of the things that we did, and I imagine you probably did this in your faith experience also, is we adopted a certain lens through which we could see the whole of reality. And reality always had to come to us through that lens, which was always asking, what does Jesus want? What would God want from us right now? And is this a sign of something that Jesus or God is somehow presenting to us and we're supposed to figure it out? And do we know? Do we know? So that lens was very important. In fact, if you would like me to, I could read a little segment out of my book about the Mennonite Well of Faith.
Yeah, please do. I'd be curious to hear it.
Okay. We looked enough like a normal Midwest farm community that you might not guess we were Mennonite, unless you knew our history, motives, thought processes, or noticed our controlled impulses and abundant gentleness. What you couldn't see revealed the most about us. Underneath our disciplined exterior burned passion. We focused it on doing what Jesus wanted. Our faith, the well from which we drank our identity, defined what our lives should be. We learned how to judge each event and where to place our trust. We knew another world loomed out there, a bad one that often dismissed our repurposing of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. My family didn't touch or taste that world, and seldom did that world intersect ours. Being held in Jesus' love and resting in his arms was poignant enough for us.
Dr. Stuckey, can you explain the Mennonite thing to me? What is the Mennonite lifestyle or the way Mennonite faith is practiced? What is it supposed to accomplish or represent?
Well, one of the things that is most prominent is that it's important to live simply and to not let the world distract you from being able to really focus on Jesus rather than all the little things about the world, like, you know, should you have pink jewelry with this dress? Or if you see what I'm saying, if you take away jewelry or if you take away some of the accoutrements that belong to the world, then you have more time and energy and the right space in your head for things that are more important, according to this Mennonite approach. The two really significant doctrines that originally got the Mennonites kind of kicked out away from the Reformation, and they became kind of the radical Reformation in the early 1600s, was believer's baptism. Rather than baptizing babies, what you did is waited for people to become old enough to make a true commitment to Christ. Any time that you could make a true commitment and really mean that you are going to follow Christ's way, then you can be baptized. That's one, and that's called believer's baptism. And the other is pacifism or nonviolence. Mennonites believe that God called us to turn the other cheek, to not hate our enemies, but to love our enemies. And as Mennonites, we were called to not do anything violent against any other person. And so that could very well mean that in the right circumstance, someday we could die for our faith. Because if somebody came at us and wanted to hurt us, we could not strike them back or be aggressive, let's say. And we would have to find other ways to protect ourselves or to deal with that. Now, I don't think that for most of us that was a huge fear as we were growing up. There was certainly, you know, if we really understood that, we might have had a little bit of kind of unconscious fear that other kids didn't have. But for the most part, we didn't expect the world to intrude on us. We were separate from the world, and nobody that we knew was going to be violent. So it just kind of wasn't a big issue.
But as I read about your memoir, The Fog of Faith, violence entered your life as a teenager?
It did, yes. And it was surprising to me because it was like the last thing I might have been prepared for or expected. And as I was a teenager, I had a boyfriend who seemed to be very, very nice and, you know, a football player and those kinds of things that I thought was really cool and didn't smoke, didn't drink, you know, all of those things that seemed right to me, even though he wasn't a Mennonite. And we got fairly close. And I think it just was one of those things where I was ready to break up and he was not. And one night he just literally flipped out and became kind of psychotic because he thought I was breaking up with him and did horrible things to me. And I finally got the police, and the police did not really do anything to protect me. So after a death-defying night, I finally figured out that there was not going to be a way to protect me. It would either take an act of God or murder to protect me. And I wasn't capable of murder, and I certainly didn't want my dad to do anything to, you know, if he were put in jail, we would all have gone under.
You felt like there might be lethal violence against you?
There had been lethal violence against me, and I knew that it could happen again.
obviously, I want to respect the details of the story and you share as much as you want. So I'm sort of navigating around that to try to find out your mindset. Did you pray to God for protection and wonder?
Did I ever? You know, I was so thankful at first to just to have my faith because I needed comfort desperately. I needed somebody to be with me. And I did. I prayed. But even that first night, well, let me say one other thing before I forget.
Sure, sure.
This is part to understand this. You would have to know this. He not only said he would kill me if I tried to leave him, but he would also kill my family. And when you're on a farm in a rural area, you only know one thing, and you do not have a way to protect yourself against what could be everyday violence. In other words, he could have come to the farm at any moment and surprised us with his gun and done anything. And there would be no way for us to know. I mean, it could be any time. So we're busy working. Some of us are inside. Some of us are outside. You know, there's no way that there can be true protection. Even if somebody sat up all night, every night with a gun, which we wouldn't have done, there still would be no protection. If somebody wants to sneak around and make it happen, they can.
And you cry out to God and say, please, God, protect me and my family.
Yes. And first, I was very surprised that that wasn't my first thought. That original night when violence came, I was doing everything in my power to fend it off, to try to talk to him, to try to make sense, to, you know, to do anything I could to save myself. And then when we were in the car and driving and I finally had a chance to think, I did stop and I prayed. And I prayed as hard as I could, desperate for help. And I was so surprised that what I always thought was true wasn't true. I realized that I was helpless, you know, that I am going to die. And as I realized that, I also realized that I always thought that if I was in some life and death situation, I'd think of the right answer. I'd figure out what to do. That's kind of what our culture tells us will happen. And all of a sudden, I was aware that that's not true. I can't think of the right answer. And I don't know what to do. So that was shocking. And then after I prayed, it was also shocking to me because I thought I was a pretty strong believer that I didn't feel a lot better. You know, did I really expect that God was going to stop Ron from killing me when that he had vowed to do that and he had told me how he was going to do that and, you know, he was driving like a maniac down the highway? Did I really think that God would do it? And if God would do it, why hadn't he already? Was he waiting for me to pray? Was he there? What was he thinking?
Are we seeing at this moment, Dr. Stuckey, the collapse of your faith, or did it take longer?
It took much longer. It took much, much longer. For years, several years, I prayed and prayed. And yet I knew, you know, did I have to go back with this person and say I won't leave you and show that I won't leave him so that nothing terrible happens to me or my family? And the only way that I wouldn't have to go back would be if God would handle this. And in my book, I say, and it would even take the least amount of effort from God, the least amount. It wouldn't even take a miracle for God to do that, because we credit God all the time with influencing people towards the good. So all that God would have to practice is a little bit of influence, and influence Ron to break up with me. And then I'd be free, my family would be free, we could go on with our lives, I wouldn't be tormented, and I would feel like God was on my side.
Your divine father had intervened on your behalf, right? You had an advocate, someone who had your back out there.
Right. With a little bit of influence, could have turned Ron's head in a different direction.
May I ask, ultimately, how did you break out of this scenario? It sounds like you're in an emotional prison and then a physical prison at the same time.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And at a young age. And I guess I broke out by becoming even more ashamed of myself, a shame that I could not bear in the context of my community. What happened, of course, is that within the next couple of years, I became pregnant. And for a young woman, for a teenage girl to be pregnant before marriage was a profound sin. And so I had to get up in front of the church, Ron and I both, but it was my church and the people who knew me, and confess.
The Mennonite culture, is that a shame culture when it comes to sex and sexuality?
It is a shame culture. It's honor and shame. But really, that's what Christianity is. Christianity does bring you closer to shame for better and worse. Because none of us would want to be shameless, you know. If we're shameless, we cannot fit into society. And so shame is an evolutionary force that guides us to fit and be more comfortable in the world in which we live.
I know, Dr. Stuckey, you're a psychotherapist today, or you have been for a great many years, decades even, correct?
Oh, yeah, over 30 years.
So now do you look back over time and analyze yourself, your young self? Do you examine forensically what you were thinking, how you were acting in that way?
Oh, yes. I've done that for many years.
And what are your observations as a healthcare, as a mental health professional? I mean, what would you say to the young version of yourself who had been going through this kind of trauma and shaming?
Well, of course, one of the first things that I would try to do is to help myself be on my own side, because in so many ways, I did not even know how to be on my own side, because, you know, if you're raped, and this is pretty much a universal experience of rape, or a universal experience of helplessness, is that there's shame involved in it. And it doesn't matter, really, that somebody else did that to me, particularly in religious worlds. Women are responsible for men's sexual behavior because they bear the shame for it. And so, yeah, I would have tried to help myself know that I needed to be for me. And that would mean to throw off some of that shame and to see the sham of shame in this circumstance.
You blamed yourself then?
Yeah, in many ways. Not only myself, because when I got pregnant, I finally decided that was it, and I was done with God, because I felt like, you know, God could blame me for things, God could torment me, God could put me in terrible situations, God could, you know, not help me. Maybe God felt like I wasn't good and I needed to be shown that I wasn't good. I mean, all of those things, we try to understand suffering through that same lens, that lens of faith. So I looked at myself and tried to think, what was God telling me? And what did this mean? And so I could believe that I was somehow being tested and I was somehow bad and I needed to I needed to do things better. And that could be God's aim in this situation by not influencing Ron to go in another direction. But I knew that God was the author of life, and nobody gets pregnant without God choosing that. And so I thought, well, at least I can count on God to help me not get pregnant. And then when I did get pregnant, what I realized is that God had no right, none, to bring an innocent baby into this situation, because that was torment for the baby too. And that was not okay. And I could justify that God would want to punish me, but not punishing an innocent baby, that was not okay. And at that point, I gave up my faith.
How old were you at the time?
17.
Short break. When I come back, Dr. Stuckey continues her story of the journey out of physical danger and out of guilt and shame, beyond the fog of faith, if I can borrow from her book. It's a compelling story, an inspiring story. It continues right after this. Even with insurance, how much does an eye exam cost you? Even if the waiting room is empty, how long does it take to go and update your prescription? And we're talking hours out of the day, right? It's a pain. But Simple Contacts is vision care for the 21st century. Now, Simple Contacts lets you renew your prescription and reorder your contacts from anywhere in minutes. You can take a $20 self-guided vision test. It takes about 5 minutes. Use your cell phone to do it, or a computer. The test is analyzed by a licensed ophthalmologist. You get an updated prescription, and Simple Contacts has all the contact brand names to choose from, so you can order right then, right there. And if your current prescription is still good, you can just upload that info and order from Simple Contacts. I wear my contacts on the road, on the tennis court, whenever I'm active. I took that test in just a few short minutes in my office at home. I had my Bausch & Lomb contacts shipped free in my mailbox in a few days. It was fast, convenient, simple, awesome. I saved half a day and about $100. It is very cool. And right now, my listeners can save $30 on lenses by going to simplecontacts.com/SethAndrews and then entering the code SethAndrews. Now, this is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. You still need those from time to time. But it is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and reorder your contacts if your vision hasn't changed. So get $30 off right now. Go to simplecontacts.com/SethAndrews. Promo code SethAndrews. I have the privilege of speaking here with Dr. Leona Stuckey. She was in an abusive relationship in her teen years, resulting in a pregnancy. She was living in a hugely conservative Mennonite community and culture. She was walking away from her faith in God. Her story continues as she joins me here. So now, walking away from your identity as a Mennonite and as a believer, you're having to rebuild brick by brick an identity of your own on your own terms, or at least attempt to. What form did that take?
Well, I have to say that I was, I felt the unmerciful shame, even though the congregation, after we confessed, the congregation forgave us. We were not shunned in any formal way. I knew that I was looked down upon. And I knew that I had brought shame to my family and to my community, and I was devastated. And so I became quite depressed. And my husband and I then, we had to get married, and we moved to another little town fairly close, and I really tried to avoid my community.
You married the person who had once threatened your life?
Who had consistently threatened my life, yes.
Is every day then a day of fear for you, fear for your safety and the safety of your child?
Yes.
Please tell me this story has a happy ending. I mean, can you tell me about your liberation?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, obviously I did get liberated. And I did learn. I learned so much. And I was very, very fortunate that I found a way to get to college. I had always wanted to go to college, but I didn't know that I was worthy of it. And I did get to go to college after I got out of that relationship. And there was a tremendous cost for getting out of that relationship. I'm not going to say what it was because I think it's important to, in terms of reading the book, that you read what it was and kind of track with me the steps. And so going to college was such a revelation. And it allowed me to find feminism because before college, I did not understand feminism at all. I can give you an example. After I got married in our little community, there I went to the bank and started an account for my husband and myself. And then I went back to that bank and wanted to draw out some money, some cash, because we needed supplies for a baby. And we had to buy it all at garage sales, so I needed cash. So I went to the bank and they said, no, you can't draw out money. And I said, well, this is my account. Why can't I? And they said, the money belongs to your husband. And so you have to have a signed note from him that tells us that it's okay with him for you to draw out this money. So I asked to speak to the manager, and he said the same thing. And I knew I was being shamed, but I didn't quite understand what to be angry about. So I went home, and that night I got a signed note, came back the next day with my signed note to get the money from my account. And I gave the note to them, and I was just like standing proud because I was trying to say to them, I am not the kind of wife who would take her husband's money without him knowing about it. And so here's the signed proof. So you see, I was so naive that I didn't even know what to be angry about in that circumstance.
I've heard stories of, you know, like wives who were not allowed to get the mail. Their husbands always would bring the mail in and go through it. And they, mm-hmm. you know, they weren't allowed to drive here or there. In the 21st century, you hear these stories.
Right. And many times, you know, it's the husband who does that. But in this case, it certainly was the husband also. But it was the bank that did that. And it just, you know, it's those kinds of things where you look back and you realize how naive you were. You couldn't even find the correct thing to be angry about.
Did the navigation through your own emotional journey lead you into psychology and psychotherapy? Was that a direct link?
Pretty direct. I had started college not knowing that that's what I wanted, but after the first year, I became a major in psychology and philosophy.
Which is not really the domain of the church. The church is very distrustful of psychology and mental health, yes?
Correct. And I went to Boston College, which I didn't even realize was a Catholic, such so Catholic as it was then. It was like all Catholic students. And everybody was straight out of college. I mean, straight out of high school. So I was very much an outsider in that world. And I remember saying, I will not take a class from a priest. And so I stuck to that rigidly for well over a year. And then some of the students told me that the priests were the best teachers. And they truly were. I took a class, and even though, I mean, they did not pound religion on people at all. And this was in the early 70s, so they had been educated by the finest universities all over the world, especially in Europe. and were pretty radical themselves. And, you know, there was a way in which we connected because of my religious heritage. They and I thought alike on a lot of things, and they were really radical activists, let's say. They believed in the social gospel, and that I believed in too. You know, I wouldn't say it was because of God, but I did believe in people being cared for.
Are you a Unitarian Universalist minister? Is that correct?
I am. I am a minister.
Are you preaching humanism? How would you frame that?
Well, I'm not preaching much because my ministry is to do psychotherapy. And so I don't do a lot of preaching. It's not like I'm a minister of a church per se. But what I have come to believe is experience near knowledge. And that is the kind of knowledge that psychotherapists have. I didn't coin that word. I can't remember who did. It was years ago. And experience near knowledge is what you gain when you listen to people day in and day out, hour in and hour out. And you see what human beings actually experience deep down inside themselves. And that knowledge, it comes, first of all, from having empathy. So with empathy, we go deeper inside of other people. And with empathy for ourselves, we go deeper inside our own selves. And when we do that for a long period of time, we gather a lot of experience near knowledge. So it makes me know why people need faith and what they're about when they say, you know, my faith helps me so much. I can appreciate what they mean. And I love the way that, I'm trying to think of a name right now.
It's all right.
It's not coming, but you know him. He's written probably 20 or 30 books now, but he talks about how it is to believe in belief.
Daniel Dennett,
that's it, or believe in God. Or, you know, the believe in belief is what most, quote unquote, Christians do. Now, I'm speaking from my experience near knowledge. I'm not trying to say how anybody should or shouldn't be judged about their belief. But I am saying experience near knowledge tells me that people believe in belief. They don't necessarily believe in God. And in fact, I would say that from experience near knowledge, most people do not, even though they say they do. They do not believe in God in the way that an experience near belief would be acted out. Let me give you an example of that. If I were to say I'm a Christian, I would have to say that I'm a really poorly acting Christian. If I really, really believed, my actions would be different because Jesus preached more than anything else and with exact clarity. He preached that you must give your money to the poor. That is the strongest message in the New Testament. If you want to get to heaven, you do not hang on to money. If you want to be considered a good human being, you have to be those who are not invited to the worldly banquets. and be those who are shunned. If you want to be a good Christian, you don't go praying out loud or in ways that people see you praying or think that you're a good person because you pray. You give your money to the poor. Now, that is the most fundamental message. And I don't hear ministers preaching that. And I don't think it's possible to say, I am a believer without doing that, at least in a primary way. And so that would call into question capitalism and buying into it in a big way. That would call into question any support for votes that demean the poor rather than uplift them. That would call into question all kinds of actions that we do. And I'll tell you why I have a hard time giving my money to the poor. It's because I do not believe that God would take care of me. I do not believe that I could withstand the horrors that would come to me if I was one of the poor. I want to be able to get health care if I absolutely need it. I cannot trust that the lilies of the field, the birds of the air, that I would be taken care of in those ways. So if anybody tried to call me a Christian, I would have to say I am a totally inadequate Christian because I don't have enough belief to do the one thing that the New Testament, Jesus and Jesus's followers absolutely demand.
Do you have a creed that you live by today? Do you have sort of a mission statement for you, Dr. Stuckey?
Yes, I do. And I have a hard time knowing exactly how to ground this creed. I wouldn't call it a creed. I would call it principle, and that's how the UU congregations do. They have principles, not creeds. And the principles are based in being a loving, caring, positive, as much as possible, moving the world in a positive direction, whatever, which would be loving and caring, to be that kind of person who is actively engaged in doing good to make the earth a better place for you having been here. For me having been here.
I'm asked from time to time about my own value system when we talk about trying to help people who are disadvantaged and trying to think less tribally and more globally, more in terms of the human condition. And one of the reasons, one of the motivators for that is I think those who live hopeless lives often will, they are more susceptible to the false claims of a religion. They're more apt to buy into the happy ending in another life because they can see no happiness in this life. And I feel in my own mind that if we can improve living conditions, the human condition for everyone, then a lot of the adherence to often damaging superstition will fall away. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Stuckey?
I do, and I thank you for bringing that up because it's one of the fundamental tenets of my book. It is not told in that way. It's told in story form. But what I discovered in my early journey, and my book only goes till I'm 23 years old, so it's an early journey. But what I discovered is that human beings are profoundly gullible, and we all are, for a story that makes them feel better, that fits what they need in the moment. And to fight that part of us that is profoundly gullible, I mean gullible to the nth degree gullible, to fight that is in some ways to fight our evolutionary inheritance. And that is, now I'm talking about a fellow named Donald Hoffman, who talks about the ways in which evolution prepared us to accept an approximation of reality and not have to go for the real thing. I tell people all the time that it's so important to walk close to reality. And I believe that. I think it's very important. Our steps are going to, we're going to be really confused all the time about who we are and what we mean if we don't try to find a way to walk close to reality. And of course, reality is a moving target, but it is a target still. And that aim, I think, makes us less gullible, and it makes us much more capable of doing what we might think of is the right thing to do in a variety of situations, just like you're talking about, in terms of helping people's lives be better. What could come from that reality if we could make that the real situation of our world? Wow, that has possibilities.
I think walk close to reality may be my new life slogan, Dr. Stuckey. I like that very much. That's fantastic. Dr. Leona Stuckey, author of the book, The Fog of Faith, Surviving My Impotent God. You can find her website at leonastuckey.com. I will include both of those links in the description box. And I would encourage my audience to take this journey to read the book and to find encouragement and inspiration from her story. Dr. Stuckey, I'm honored that you would spend the time talking to me. Your story is compelling and I think will help a tremendous number of people. Thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the work that you do, Seth. You take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.